are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Eric Bushnell. On tonight's program, Liz Olds talks with world-renowned radio personality Mark Thompson, heard every morning for 25 years on the nationally syndicated Mark and Brian Show. Delivers the story of a lifetime in his memoir, Don't Bump the Record, Kid, My Adventures with Mark and Brian. Don't Bump the Record, Kid offers a fascinating behind-the-scenes look at morning drive of the celebrities, the studio politics, the passionate fans, and the incredible live music and ingenious comedy bits that pumped life into 2.5 decades of entertainment every weekday morning for generations of listeners all over the country.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, Dave Fettig talks with Ruby Blue, the author of the poetry collection The Sun, The Moon, The Truth. In addition to her poetry, Ruby is also a lyricist, musician, and educator. She headlines the band Red Eye Ruby, a Minneapolis-based group that taps into the roots of rock music with funky, up-tempo grooves. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hello, Mark. Are you there?
I am. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot for being a guest here on Right On Radio tonight.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with your reading from your book?
I am ready when you are.
We are ready.
All right. I'm going to begin with the very first chapter, or near the top. Let's do it. Early 1985. Quote, one of my favorite things is there is no certainty. I could get a phone call that could change everything, good or bad. I never know. End quote, Sam Levine. The call came one morning in early February 1985. It was a call I didn't expect that presented me with a scenario I'd never considered. I was living in Montgomery, Alabama, doing afternoons at Y102 FM. In my many years of traveling the radio road, I lived in several beautiful cities, but Montgomery wasn't one of them. It's not that it was bad, it was just there. I remember trees and concrete. The memorable cities I lived in had a distinct beauty. Montgomery just wasn't one of them. I was in year 12 of my radio career, and by now, a seasoned radio entertainer. I was number one in afternoons, so going to the mall on weekends was dicey, as teenagers who listened to me were there. Not that it was a Beatle riot, but it was enough of a thing that it made me uncomfortable, so I just didn't go. My first taste of radio fame was 3 years prior in Birmingham, Alabama, where I did nights at 96 WERC. I was invited to a high school pep rally, and the teacher who invited me took me into the gymnasium and told me to wait by the rafters until they introduced me. The air was thick and stuffy and smelled like sweaty socks. The place was packed with students, the football team, and a microphone standing center court. Some goober stepped up to the mic. Ladies and gentlemen from 96 WERC, please welcome Mark Thompson. I started walking out when the roar hit, and it shocked me. I didn't realize they would even know who I was, and I admit I was a bit uneasy. I don't remember what I said, but it was basically yay school. I turned to leave as the wall of screams hit me again. Melodramatic as it may sound, I was never the same, but not in the way you might think. It was my first lesson in the frailty of celebrity. It feels good in the moment, but it doesn't last. Pride is something you can hold on to. Fame isn't.
That's Mark Thompson reading from his book, Don't Bump the Record, Kid, a book written by one of the, a member of the Radio Hall of Fame, among other things. Mark, what inspired you to write a memoir right now?
I didn't mean for it to be a memoir. I was just going to tell the story of the 27 years that I was with Brian. But I learned to respect the creative process many years ago. And sometimes when you light that creative ball and you study it and you sit with it, you learn to follow it, even if it takes you down a path you didn't expect. So what was just supposed to be the story of Mark and Brian turned into a full-blown memoir with me going back into my early solo career, my childhood, and the years afterwards. I honestly felt like the legacy of Mark and Brian was being forgotten and slipping away, and I wanted to chronicle it.
What made you love radio?
When I was a kid, I couldn't sleep, and it was because of my father. He wouldn't let us turn on any lights in the house at night. So I don't have to tell you what a 10-year-old's imagination can do in a pitch-black house. And I couldn't sleep, but I learned if I turned on my radio, the light from the dial would illuminate my room enough that I could see the monster that was going to eat me. And I would lay there, and it worked. I slept. And each night I would lay there and I would listen to the radio and listen to the jock's voice, the tonality. I could hear the needle scratch through the vinyl. I could even hear the air conditioner turn on inside the control room. And it was then that I fell in love with what radio was, because it became my friend and I wanted to be a part of it.
And how did you end up getting involved? I mean, I know your love turned into your life's work, basically. So what were the first steps of getting involved in actually doing radio?
Well, I went and said, I was 16. I went to every radio station I knew and I said, I want to be a disc jockey. And I was told, well, you can't do that until you've got experience. And of course, it's the chicken or the egg. How do I get experience if you don't hire me? I wound up getting a job at a country station daytimer, which means they sign on at sun up, sign off at sundown. And the guy said, I don't have any on-air jobs, but I can hire you to clean up at the end of the day. And then at night, after we've signed off, you can practice. And so I took the job and I started as a janitor. I would, you know, empty the trash and wipe out the ashtrays. And then I would go in the control room and I would practice. And it dawned on me that if I rolled tape and recorded my practice, it would sound like I was on the air. So that's what I did. And I took the tape back to the stations that said I couldn't work there, and I gave them the tape. I never physically said the words, I was on the air, but I got hired.
What were some of the stations you were? You were in the South, right? Alabama?
Yes, ma'am. Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Oh, great. Great. I know what that means. you did some radio and then you met your longtime co-host, but you first met him when you were doing this kind of radio. And how did you meet Brian, and how did you guys know that you were going to hit it off as radio talent?
I was fairly successful at this point. Around 85, I'd been doing my solo radio personality work and it was going very well. And I got a call from a dear friend, Mark St. John. He and I had known each other for years. He was my program director and a dear friend. And he called me and he said, have you ever considered taking on a partner? And I didn't know how to answer because I hadn't. I thought I was just going to do this on my own. That was never a thought that I had. But he said, I've got a guy that I think you should meet. And this guy, Brian, was an improvisational comedian out of Chicago. The problem was that he had never been on the air. Mm-hmm. He had never been in a radio station. And I thought, how can that work? But I agreed to meet with him. And so we sat down and we talked for hours. And I really didn't, going into the meeting, I didn't think much about it. I didn't think there was much of a chance, but I liked him. And it wasn't until the very end of our talk when I realized I was going to do it, when I found out that Brian had the exact same love and respect for the humor of David Letterman as I did. And it was then that I knew, I'm going to give this a try. This could work.
And what did you do starting out to make it work? I mean, how did you begin? You did a lot of improv over the years, if I'm not mistaken. And how did you get started doing that again? How did you know it was going to click when you were trying to do the improv and he met you back with the yes, as they often say in improv. Talk more about how that worked.
Well, we went on the air the first day, and I prepared the show as if I was going to be alone, because I didn't know what to expect from Brian. He had never been in a radio station, and he did a very smart thing. He didn't say much that first show. He sat and he watched and he listened and he observed, and he was looking to see where he might fit in. And the show went very well. When he did speak, it was funny. And he was just figuring, it's kind of like driving a car or flying an airplane. You want to sit in the cockpit before you do it. And then each day, gradually, he just got better and more comfortable and more comfortable. And right off the bat, we were connected in a way. We would finish each other's sentences. We were traveling along the same comedy road. So it was an instantaneous connection between us.
And you got very popular, and you wanted to work in a major market, and then KLOS calls. What was that feeling like when that happened?
Well, it was unbelievable, actually, because in the world of radio, I don't know about other businesses, but Birmingham, where we were number one, and we had quite a buzz going. And Birmingham is a medium-sized market. And so the next logical step is to a large market, something like Atlanta and St. Louis. And both of those cities were vying for our presence in their radio station. And in the middle of that, KLOS called. And by taking that job, we skipped a step. Instead of going to large from a medium, we went straight to major market, which was kind of unheard of. A lot of people didn't give us a chance because it was quite a leap for us and quite a vote of confidence from Los Angeles and KLOS.
How long did it take you to jump up to number one? It sounded in the book like it happened fairly quickly.
It did. When we got to KLOS, the big act in town was Rick Dees. And Rick was the big dog. And Rick did your standard type of morning radio, very fast-paced, a lot of moving parts. His basic humor was set up punchline record, set up punchline commercial. And we went in and we didn't do that kind of radio. We didn't have punchlines. We didn't tell jokes. We would deal with scenarios that were funny. And so we wound up doing a very unique kind of morning radio that nobody had really heard, including us, because we were making it up as we went. But I think because we were so different from Rick or anybody else in LA, and because we were good, we hit number one within a year and a half.
And what was different, or was it the same between Birmingham and L.A., what you did as your, shtick, I don't know if that's a good word or not, but, your routines, was anything different, or did you just stick to the same thing?
No, it was very different, but not by any design. When we were in Birmingham, we also were doing a standard form morning show. We were doing funny characters, saying funny things, reading stories about weird people doing weird things. And we were very good at it. And that's why we got the job in LA. But when we got to Los Angeles, we had taken a job at KLOS, which is a classic rock radio station. And I was listening to it as soon as I got to LA, and I realized, God, what are we going to do? I didn't know literally half of the songs they played. I didn't know what they were because I had never listened to classic rock. And so the very first day we got on the air, I told Brian, we're going to hit the ground running. We don't fit in here. And so we're just going to do what we do. This is why they hired us. We're not going to try to fit in. We're just going to do our thing. And we hit the air and we started making fun of the music. And then listeners started calling, yelling at us because we were downgrading their music. And then we made fun of them. But we weren't rude. We were playful. And we were the most hated men in Los Angeles for about the first 3 months. But the thing of it is that even though we were making fun of them and the music, there was a smile in our rudeness. And one of the number one comments I still get to this day is, I hated you guys when you first got here. But the key to it was they knew our name. Everybody was talking about us because we were not what they were looking for.
Now, you've interviewed a lot of famous people. I'm wondering who were some of the ones that you enjoyed the most.
Well, I mean, you're right. In Los Angeles, we met and had a chance to sit down for a couple of hours with many. I'll give you two that come to mind. One would be the best, and that was Tom Cruise. He came in when he was doing Interview with a Vampire. And a lot of the big name stars come in with a whole entourage of people. Mel Gibson came in with 15. Tom came in with one, his sister. And Tom could not have been more engaging, friendly, funny. He listened. He was serious. He stayed for 2 hours. He had a blast. And we had a ton of people who worked at the station come in early so that they could take a look at him. And after Tom finished the show with us, he made sure he signed every autograph, took every picture, and said hello to every single person. I don't know that I've ever been more impressed with a big name than I was with Tom. And then one of the oddest that I hated, because I'm a fan of Christopher Walken. He was coming in to promote his role in Batman. And I was really excited because I'm a big fan of his work. And he came in. And normally when a guest is brought in, I'll spend the first few minutes making them comfortable. Do you need coffee? Do you want water? Whatever. And as I was doing that, before we had gone on the air, he looked at me and he said, "Could you stop talking, please?" And I stared at him thinking that he was joking. He wasn't. So I stopped talking. And right above our heads are our studio monitors, which are these giant speakers that we listen to the commercials from. That's why we hang them from the ceiling. And he pointed at the speakers and he said, "Could you turn these off, please?" And we did. And so we sat in silence for 5 minutes, no speaking, no talking, no sound, nothing. And I knew then this can't go well. And we got on the air and it didn't matter how praising the questions were that I asked, he just wasn't having it. He would answer in one or two word answers. So I quickly got him out. And the only thing that I can think is that there's a contract in every actor's contract that they have to promote the movie. And I have to think that on that particular day, Christopher just didn't want to be there. And he made sure we knew it.
We're speaking with Mark Thompson, author of Don't Bump the Record Kid, a Radio Hall of Fame member who worked with Brian Phelps as Mark and Brian in Los Angeles and prior to that in Birmingham. I'm curious, you write an essay in the back of the book about being a Southern boy. And I'm wondering what it was like to go from being a Southern boy to being in this massive mega city and how that affected you or how you felt about doing that.
Well, I didn't have any reservations about it. I was excited because this is Los Angeles, but the very first, I mean, it's got to be the culture shock central city of the world. When I got there, physically got there, we stayed in a hotel right off the 405 and the 101 freeway. And I sat on the balcony of my hotel room and I noticed the traffic, 6 lanes going each way. And the shocking part of it is it didn't matter if it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon or 1 o'clock in the morning, the traffic never stopped. And I had never seen that. And then the other big part of it being in Los Angeles is that you're constantly reminded you're not in Kansas anymore. I was going to meet a friend for breakfast one morning in Santa Monica and I couldn't find it. And I saw a couple walking alongside the road, and I pulled over and I said, I'm trying to find the Rose Cafe. And the guy leaned into the window of my car and he said, it's right back here. It's small. It's easy to miss. And he told me how to get there, and I drove off. And I was proud of myself for not making a scene that Jackson Brown had just given me instructions as to how to get to the restaurant. And so you have to get used to that, because you're going to see celebrities. You're going to see places in a city that you've always heard about and seen pictures of, and now you live there. So it is culture shock central, and you have to get used to it. But on top of that, the traffic, LA is a big city, and it's dirty, and there's people. And so it was a lot to take in, but make no mistake, I loved it. It's one of the unique cities in the world.
You have a great story about E.T. and your backyard. Would you share that to us?
Sure. My son at the time was 6 months old when we first moved to L.A. We were living on Kilfinan Street in Northridge, a rental. And so after Matthew would get up from his nap, Linda and I would load him in his stroller and take him out. There was a neighborhood park right down the road from our house. So we would go down there. And Matthew, out of all the things they had swings and all kinds of things. But Matthew was attracted to this caterpillar thing. It was a kind of a thing you'd climb on. And he ignored all of the other stuff. He would climb on that caterpillar. It had a caterpillar head and a caterpillar tail, and that's what he loved. So a few months after we had discovered the park and Matthew was enjoying the caterpillar, Matthew and I were sitting in the living room one afternoon watching E.T. on TV. And I wasn't paying much attention, doing something. And then I heard Matthew start making noise and pointing at the television. And I looked up, and it was the part of the movie in E.T. where Elliot was on his bike and E.T. was in the front basket and Elliot was running from the bad guys. And Elliot rode his bike through a park that had a caterpillar gymnasium. And I realized then that scene was filmed not 300 feet from my front door. And it's there that you realize, seriously, you're not in Kansas. The movie E.T. was filmed right there. And my son plays on that gymnasium right there on TV.
That's great. What do you attribute your huge success over the years to?
Hard work, originality. I never was attracted to doing the same thing everybody else was doing. I was attracted to what I liked and what I thought was funny and what I thought was interesting. And I always prepared a radio show that I would want to hear. And if I'm on the air and somebody's listening to me do that, and they don't like it, then they're going to leave. And I'm fine with that, because I'm not looking for you. I'm looking for people that think like I do. And that becomes your fan base. But I don't think it matters what business you're in. Nothing will ever replace hard work. And the key to any successful business person is consistency. It does you no good to be fantastic on Tuesday and mediocre on Wednesday. Consistency is one of the hardest things anybody will do, because it never stops if you're great. It never ends. And those that can do it every day are the winners.
I've just got a couple minutes left. Let's wrap up with you telling us about what it feels like to have your names on the Walk of Fame, to be in the Radio Hall of Fame. How do these things make you feel? How did they make you feel at the time, and how do you feel about them now?
Look, I've won many awards in my career, and they all mean a lot, and I love having them. But when I was selected to become a member of the Radio Hall of Fame, that is a very, very small room filled with very few people who were deemed as the best to ever do it in history. And I'm one of them. I'm in that room with Bing Crosby, Abbott and Costello, Lucille Ball, some of the greats, and I'm in that room. There's no words. There's no way to say that a redneck kid from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, could climb the ladder and be welcomed into the greatest honor that anybody could receive in any form of business, the best to ever do it. I was excited when I was inducted, and I am as excited, maybe more so today, because that they cannot take away from me.
Well, and congratulations for that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us. We've run out of time here on Right on Radio for our interview with Mark Thompson, author of Don't Bump the Radio, Kid. I love that title. And thank you so much for being here with us tonight.
Thank you, Liz.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Fettig, and I am really pleased to invite to our studio live Ruby Blue. Hi, Ruby.
Hi.
Wake Grandma and Grandma, get the kids away from those electronic devices and gather around the radio console, everybody, because this is a great show. Ruby's here with her guitar. She's a poet, a lyricist, a musician, a band leader. But right now, we're going to talk about poetry. We're about books. Ruby is just out with a book, The Sun, the Moon, the Truth, a collection of her poetry. So before we have a reading, Ruby, let's talk about your history as a writer and how you came to be a poet. You talk about this in your intro, but let's hear the story about you and poetry.
Yeah, I started writing rhymed poetry when I was 12. I read Emily Dickinson and got really inspired.
That's serious stuff.
Yeah, the way that her words kind of click together, right? And of course, once I got to college and learned more about this stuff, I learned that I was reading in what people call an iambic pentameter, right?
Sure.
It's that do da do da do da do kind of thing that she does. So that and the rhyming kind of inspired me from a young age to write my own poems that kind of did that, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of had that sort of pace and the rhyme and stuff. And then, you know, as I got a little older, I got into other poets. Like, I got really into E.E. Cummings.
Yeah.
And Charles Bukowski.
Oh, Charles Bukowski, amazing.
And so my poetry shifted a little bit, but that rhymed poetry, I kept writing it, but then I would just put it to music.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, so yeah, but I've always loved poetry. There's something, it's just the way it makes me feel,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep,
like,
absolutely.
Yeah, there's something about it.
We love our poets here on KFAI. We're going to talk a little more about that, how you came to collect these and why. But with that as an introduction, let's have a reading, if you would please, Ruby.
Yeah, I will read a poem that I like to read this in the fall as the weather's getting cold. It's a little cold now, but I think it still fits. This poem is called Hello, Mr. Spider. Hello, Mr. Spider. I like your pretty legs and the webs you weave with molten string and death you weave with poison dreams. The Octavian rhythm you stamp into the carpet is archaic, embedded. I won't fight. I won't flight. I'll help you find the door. You're a dancer, a prancer, an ethereal prince. You'll find somewhere warm, Mr. Spider, because there's a chill in the wind. October is coming again. I hope you keep your long legs warm, Mr. Spider, and all those hexagon eyes fixed on a glowing dream of summer.
It's Ruby Blue reading from her new collection of poems, The Sun, the Moon, the Truth. So this was an earlier poem, and I know that because it's the first one.
Yeah.
And you've organized your book in a certain way. Tell us how you organized your book, and how old were you when you wrote Mr. Spider?
I wrote that when I was in junior college. I was 19.
Okay.
Yeah, I was a teenager when I wrote that one. And I don't know if it's the earliest piece, actually. That first sort of section, I open with that.
Mm-hmm.
But really, there's a few that are even before that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And again, you organized this book in a certain way. Tell us what you did here.
Yeah, so I took poems from different times in my life. And I kind of organized them. I organized the chapters chronologically,
mm-hmm.
but the poems are achronological within the chapters.
Gotcha.
To kind of, because I wanted them to flow with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if I get too worked up about, oh, this one I wrote first or whatever, it would kind of mess with the flow.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah.
It's like lining up the songs on an album.
Yeah.
In a certain way. Yep.
Yeah.
There's a lot of nature in these early poems.
Yeah.
Is nature a big thing for you in terms of your poetry and your writing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think I think that I've always been really inspired by nature,
mm-hmm.
you know, and looking at, the poem Misty Morning talks about frozen
exactly.
raindrops and fairies yep. and, you know, it's just kind of like, you know, all these different pieces that I think make me feel the way that nature makes me feel,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that's kind of the goal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have your guitar in hand.
I do.
We're going to talk about music. But when you were writing, are you thinking of a poem? Are you thinking of your words as poems, as lyrics? How do you draw a line? Is it blurry for you? Does it matter for you?
Yeah. So, yeah, I actually separate them quite
okay.
a bit. So, and my process for writing songs, so it's very easy for me to sit down and free write poetry that's kind of free verse and doesn't really rhyme or will kind of rhyme randomly.
Okay.
That's a pretty easy exercise for me to sit down and do that. So what I'll do with my songs, it's more difficult for me to write the kind of like metered rhyming poems. So I will write like a piece that just kind of comes out of me that doesn't rhyme and it's free verse. And then I will actually take that piece when I sit down with my guitar. And then write my lyrics based off of the free verse poem. And so that's kind of where this actually, the idea for the poetry book came from. There's a poem in here that actually is based off of the song Mockingbird on my record that I just put out.
Yep.
And that poem is, what's the title to it here? It's something about in the darkness of the night, or in the dark of the night is
yes,
what it's
in
called.
The dark of the night.
Dark of the night. That's what it is. And that, this poem, this free verse poem, I took that and I turned that into Mockingbird on the record. And I just pulled different pieces and just made them rhyme.
Fascinating. So now we have to hear it.
Yeah.
By the way, I have that album, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and you can too. And where can they find your music?
Well, you can find it on any major music streaming platform.
Of course.
I've got it up on Apple Music, Spotify, Tidal. Anywhere that you stream music, it's there.
Yeah.
And you can also go to my website, redeyeruby.com.
Wow, awesome.
Yep, and it's there as well.
We're going to talk about where to get this book, too,
and
your poetry.
Yeah.
But since we introduced this idea of this poem, Dark of the Night, let's hear that.
Okay.
Wonderful.
It's a tune called Mockingbird.
In the dark of the night, I saw you. You were whistling a lullaby. So truth in your eyes. Yeah, the waxing moon is shining, straight whiskey home. 'cause the city is dying now. Oh, mockingbird, sweet mockingbird, wherever do you fly? Out across the darkness, shining in the sky. Yeah, the North Pacific goes rolling. Pine needles in my hair. Lay me down, my darling. You can have me anywhere. The dark forbidden night, you were warm in the pale moonlight, and we've got no one to run to, so just kiss me here. Yeah, these melodies, they ring through the darkness. Music finds me everywhere. And love's always inside me, whether I'm here or I'm there. Oh, mockingbird, sweet mockingbird, wherever do you fly? Out across the darkness, shining in the sky. Dark forbidden night, you were warm in the pale moonlight, and we've got nowhere to run to, so just kiss me here tonight.
Everybody, hey, fantastic. That was Ruby Blue singing Mockingbird from her latest album, based on a poem of her, from her book, The Sun, the Moon, the Truth. I was following along, Ruby. It was fascinating to look at the poem while you were singing.
Yeah.
And to see what you pulled out.
Yeah.
I wonder if we should give the people a taste of the poem, at least the first stanza,
sure.
While yeah. everything is still fresh.
Yeah.
Can you find that? It's in page.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 72, I believe.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk a little bit more about how you do that. By the way, nailing the bar
there
chords. I just started playing guitar a couple years ago. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not that good. That
They're
was beautiful,
tricky.
By the way.
They're tricky. Thank you.
Lovely.
Thank you. I wrote that right in April of 2020. And it's kind of about sneaking off in the woods with an old boyfriend. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Well, should I read a little bit of the poem?
Let's do that. I think that'd be nice, having just heard the music.
I'm going to do the first two stanzas.
Perfect.
Okay. It was the dark of the night when I met my estranged lover in the woods. The sounds of songbirds rang through the stillness, and I knew it was him that was singing. A mockingbird, my love, and his melodies rang through the darkness. He grew a mustache when he was away, and his body was warm in the pale light of that waxing crescent moon. Happy to see me, he took me in his arms in the deep, dark cold of that still and forbidden night.
It seems wrong to stop there. Do you want to keep going?
Sure.
Please.
The people were shut in their houses. The city closed down, citizens jobless. A virus was spreading in dark, empty streets, and a melancholy stillness sang through the night. The sounds of that northern Pacific rolling by. We drank Jim Beam in the moonlight, waxing poetic, remembering. And I can still smell pine needles, the dirt sticking to my skin as you held me. You always inside me, both of us covered by the still of the air, our skin intertwining in the deep, dark still of the night.
Thank you, Ruby. Ruby Blue reading from The Sun, the Moon, and the Truth. So when those words are coming out, and I think you indicated that you often write quickly,
mm-hmm.
Then you probably go back and edit.
Mm-hmm.
Are you hearing music? Are you thinking music? We started touching on this, and I know you said you keep them separate. I'm just, mm-hmm. I can't believe, it must be hard to do. I guess I'll say that.
You know, it's the way, like, I think when I first started reading E.E. Cummings, I started to develop, like, this really appreciation for the way that words roll off the page and the way that they kind of just naturally roll off our tongues, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when I write like that, I'm really just thinking about the way they fit together just being spoken.
Okay.
And then I don't imagine a melody at all until I pull them out and put them in kind of the Emily Dickinson style.
Yeah.
Da, 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 yeah. da, da, you know?
Yeah. yeah.
In the dark of the night, I saw you. You were, you know, whistling a lullaby.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not until I put it into those constraints that I'm able to be like, there's a melody.
Huh.
Yeah.
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 A question happened here. Musicians, writers asked musical writers is what comes first, the lyrics or the music?
Yeah, good question. For me, it's almost always the lyrics.
It is.
Because it's an idea, to me, and this is just me, but since I'm a writer first, I started writing before I started making music. So the melody, the words are the melody is a vehicle for the words in my mind. Like I'm not going to, the melody is going to be different if the words are different, right?
Sure. Yep.
I'm gonna make a melody that sounds different if I'm talking about something happy versus something sad.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. I hear Northern Pacific.
Yeah.
And I think of the old train station in Bismarck, North Dakota, my hometown, and
my hometown
and Ruby's hometown. Is that what you're thinking of? Is that what we?
Yeah. Yeah. This poem is actually about a specific night. And we sat drinking Jim Beam in the moonlight, and it was right by, there was trains that were going over us, I don't know. And I just remember sitting there drinking Jim Beam and, you know.
I grew up very close to those train tracks. I heard them all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's loud.
It's super loud. Yeah. So how did you come from Bismarck to Minneapolis, and what was your journey there?
Yeah. I came here in 2012 to go to the U of M.
Nice.
Yep. Yeah, it was either University of Montana or University of Minnesota. And I came here. I wanted the big city life, you know? Yeah, the big city of Minneapolis was shining bright, you know, when I was growing up in North Dakota. And yeah, I came here in 2012 and I started going to the U and I just never really stopped. I went to the U for like 7 years.
No,
and then
great.
Finally I was like, okay, I think this is very expensive. I need to be done here.
That's true too. When did you pick up a guitar?
I picked up a guitar. Well, actually, I first picked up a guitar when I was 11. My mom put myself and my twin sister in classical guitar lessons at 11.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah, it was really cute. And she went into mortgage lending, and I am a guitar player. So it's kind of like, you know, you throw a bunch of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks.
Yes.
For me, guitar stuck.
Yeah.
But I kind of thought guitar was boring, and I was like, oh, I don't want to play this. This is dumb. And so I stopped playing it when I was... I think it was 9 to 11 that I played, and then I took a break, and then when I got to be 13, 14, I discovered Jimi Hendrix and blues music.
Ooh, wow.
And then, of course, I was like, I'm going to play guitar, you know, because it's cool, right?
Once
I was a teenager, it was no longer just something my mom wanted me to do. It was now something that I actually felt called to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been playing, and then I took a little bit of a break, you know, a few times as a teenager, but I really got back into playing when I was 20 and never stopped.
When did the performance start?
When I was 20.
When it's 20,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and my first performance, you might know this, is at the Walrus in Bismarck.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yep. Yeah, it's still there. Yeah, it's been a long-standing institution. Yeah.
Wow, good for you. I hope they enjoyed you. They liked you.
Yeah, I mean, who's to say back then, right? They were certainly kind to have me up there. I will say that.
Right. And you are a teacher.
Yes.
An educator.
I am.
A music teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to tell us a little bit about
that? Yeah, yeah. I teach, well, I've been at Twin Town Guitars teaching private music lessons now for about, well, coming on 3 years. Mm-hmm. But I also, part of the U of M stuff, I ended up getting a master's in education, elementary nice. Education. Nice. So I have been really enjoying teaching elementary school kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to teach like third grade or fourth grade. I'd be like a general teacher. But since I've kind of finished the master's, it's opened up my ability to just go and be a music teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually just picked up a position at Barton Elementary School teaching K-5 music,
hey,
which I'm really excited
congratulations.
About.
Congratulations. Aren't they lucky? That'll be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So let's go back to the poetry.
Yeah.
And talk about how people can find your book and how it was published. Let's tell that story.
Yeah. My parents have a publishing company.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I could have like done the thing, like put the book together and pitched it to people mm-hmm. and done all that work. But I wanted it to be, you know, I grew up with my parents publishing books.
Yeah.
I grew up watching them publish stuff, right?
That's wonderful.
And I thought, I want them to publish my, you know, like, I want it to be me now. Like,
yeah.
I want to watch, I want them to do this for me, right? So my mom was a huge help. My dad was a huge help, too. But my mom really did a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of helping me format it and
nice.
Getting things, yeah, she's an InDesign master.
Oh.
Yeah.
Great. Well, yeah. Good job, Mom and Dad.
Yeah.
And that's Smoky Water Press.
Yes.
In Bismarck.
Yeah. And they have a lot of stuff. Dakota BookNet is theirs as well. And they sell a lot of North Dakota authors on their website.
Very
and so
cool.
Smoky Water Press and Dakota BookNet are very closely related. And you can purchase my book on Dakota BookNet as well.
Dakota BookNet, everyone. Mm-hmm. When we have poets on the show, we like to ask them how they work. We've gotten into this a little bit. So do you write all the time? Do you get up in the morning and write? Do you carry a notebook with you? Are you inspired? Is that when you write? Or do you think, I need some lyrics. I got to put a song together. How does it work?
Yeah, sometimes I feel like poems are like these just little spirits that float around, and I just grab them sometimes.
Yeah.
When I feel inspired, they'll just come to me.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have a pen and paper, and sometimes I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, I like my phone because a lot of times I'll just pull up my notes app and just get it in there right
sure.
before it's gone.
Yep.
But sometimes I lose it and it's gone. I'll think, oh, that's a great idea. I'm going to write it down. And then I don't write it down. And then it just poof, it's gone.
Yeah.
But I've heard a lot of people say, especially novelists, that writing is a lot of work
mm-hmm.
and that they sit down and they write from 9 to 5 and that's what they do.
Yep.
I'm not like that with poetry. I mean, poetry, of course, is much more whimsical. But no, I really just write when I want to.
Okay.
It's very much just, I want to do this. I'm going to do this right now. A lot of times it's if I'm feeling extra emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you put this book together and you arranged it chronologically, roughly speaking, in sections, did you feel like there were gaps? Or on the other hand, did you have so much? Were you winnowing things?
Mm-hmm. I was definitely winnowing stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
I was winnowing stuff, but it was also, I mean, I'll be honest, it was a very painful process to
Why?
Do this book.
How?
Because I went back, you know, I thought, oh, it's such a cute idea. I'll go and find all the poems I've ever written since I was 16, 17 years old and put them in a book. But what I didn't anticipate, you know, my mom came to visit and she brought this huge box of old writings from high school. And
wow.
some of that stuff I was going through and I was like, I don't know if I was ready to uncover that memory. Right? Like
Good
some
point.
Of these writings
yeah,
were very like, oh, okay. Like there's that memory that I repressed. Great.
I understand. I want very little to do with my teenage years. I'd rather not even think about them. Well, that's
a
good point.
I'm glad I did it though.
Yeah.
You know, but there were certain things that I did not use for that reason that I was like, there's no way I'm putting this in print.
These are very personal poems.
Yeah.
Did you have trouble, and you just addressed that when you put things in they were about yourself, so you could be as vulnerable as you wanted.
Yeah.
How about when it comes to other people, even if you don't mention people directly, you allude to them, the song we just heard. How did you curate other people in your poems in this book?
Yeah, you know, there's some superstars in the poetry book, people that just keep showing up, right? But it's interesting because sometimes, you know, I don't know if people necessarily know who they are if they were to go through and read the poems. Maybe like a couple ex-boyfriends would go, oh, that's totally about me, right? One in particular, because he read a lot of my poetry.
He's so vain, he probably thinks this poem is about
him,
right?
He's so vain. Yeah, but the truth is it probably is if he thinks it is. Yeah, I think in my poetry, I've always tried to capture just kind of like people's generous human spirits. You know, and even if I'm mad at somebody or I don't like them, I try not to write ill words about others. I don't know.
There's no nasty songs about people.
I try to keep it. I try to keep the vibes like pretty like loving as much as I can.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just got the 2-minute warning. Can you believe this, ladies and gentlemen? We're already at the 2-minute warning. So humor. There's humor in these poems. Is humor important to you when you're writing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It pops out. I laughed at a few of these. Yeah. The Palmer Bar one. You probably know that one by heart.
Yeah, I do.
Okay, what's the story? Go ahead and recite it, and then tell us where the heck this thing came from.
The Palmer's one.
Palmer's Bar, page 80.
Page 80. Here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go.
You won't need to read it too closely because you got it memorized.
I won't smoke pot in the Palmer's bathroom. I won't smoke pot in the Palmer's bathroom. I won't smoke pot in the Palmer's bathroom.
That's the poem, kids.
Yep. So we had a residency. Red Eye Ruby, my band, had a residency at Palmer's Bar.
How cool is that?
And it was fun. It was a fun time for the band. And there was, you know, I think that throughout the band, there was maybe some temptations in the bathroom.
Sure.
And that's all I'll say.
I can't believe that.
Yeah. Not of me, of course.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up.
Yeah.
And we want to ask you if you can tell us anything about the band. Are you playing anytime soon or anything else we should know? Give us the websites and then we're going to say goodbye.
Yeah. So we are playing at the First Avenue 7th Street entry on February 2nd.
Okay.
Yep.
February 2nd, everyone.
Yep. And you can find more of our stuff at redeyeruby.com.
Redeyeruby.com. And the book, Smoky Water Press, The Sun, the Moon, the Truth. What a treat. To have Ruby Blue here in the studio. Maybe we'll have you back someday. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be nice. I'd love that.
Bye now. And now this.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Mark Thompson, Ruby Blue, and all of our listeners. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/Right on Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite Right on Radio episodes on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and so on. Please stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.